You're listening to New Hampshire Now with Chris Ryan, presented by the New Hampshire College and University Council.
This is New Hampshire Now on 9-1450 and nhtalkradio.com. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for the program this hour of the show, brought to you by New England College as well as Riverbend Community Mental Health. In the segment of the program presented by Rath Young and Pignatelli and rathlaw.com. As we continue our ARP series focusing on issues affecting the middle class here in New Hampshire, we're honored to be joined here at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics by U.S. Senator and Democratic presidential candidate Cory Booker. Cory, great to see you.
It is so good to be here and on the radio with you all.
Excited to have you back with us. And I want to start off just with kind of an upshot as to how you see the campaign at this point in time. And, you know, obviously we're getting closer. We're 5 weeks out. Are you just still looking at this and saying, I have a shot, I'm going to win this thing? What are the challenges that you've seen in terms of trying to get to that goal?
Well, I'm so happy you asked that, because I think people in New Hampshire and early primary states know that the national polls have never been predictive, even though it seems like we're putting even more emphasis on them now.
Right.
When you have everybody from, in fact, every president in my lifetime was never somebody who was polling ahead more than a month out. I mean, the people polling ahead have never gone on to the White House. So mm-hmm. Clinton, Carter, single digits. Barack Obama, national polls going into Iowa had him about 18 points behind mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton, but they all were upset. I mean, Bill Clinton came here and became the comeback kid. Carter came here and upset and won. So we know that the metrics that really matter, which is organization, people who've committed to either vote for you or caucus for you, people who are endorsing you, net favorabilities, are you liked as a candidate? All these things, we're at the very top of the field. And so we are psyched, whether it's from Iowa, New Hampshire, leading in the top two or three candidates in endorsements. I saw Iowa's net favorability numbers. We're the third most popular candidate mm-hmm. in the field in Iowa. So we are having all of these good measures, but the most one that gets me excited the most is just the momentum. You know, there hasn't been an early state poll since early November. Multiple candidates have dropped out. There's been two debates since then. We know we're feeling energy going because of what's happening with our organizers on the ground, and interestingly, what's happening with online donations, which people are saying, wait, we want Cory Booker in this race. So we're seeing an uptick in all of our metrics at the right time, because what I see in presidential politics of past, people who peak late are the ones that usually go on and win.
You have a unique understanding of the middle class because of your upbringing, your background, and the way you live your life even today. And you know, to me, and Todd and I talked about this yesterday on the show, there is not a significant difference if you look at the bank accounts of a poor person
yes.
and a middle class person. And with the student loan debts, the healthcare costs, and all these rising costs around a middle class family, there is really a house of cards that exists for the middle class, very similar to what you see with individuals who are poor. And obviously, there's certain advantages that individuals have, and I acknowledge that. But if you're just talking about bank accounts and the type of difficulty and stress that a middle class family has to put their kids through school and to try to live the best life, that struggle is real. And I'm curious, as president, what would you do to try to create a life where I don't think the middle class is looking for a handout. I don't think they're looking for much, but they want, in my view, some feeling that they don't have to be as stressed about life and the economy and putting food on the table and all the challenges that come with that.
God, I you have no idea how much I appreciate your question. It's one of the reasons all my life I've done what I've done, working in low-income neighborhoods.
Right.
But knowing, as you said, coming from a middle-class neighborhood. In fact, New Jersey, we did an analysis about how insecure economically people are. Most Americans can't deal with a $400 shock to their mm-hmm. system, two flat tires or challenges away from having to sell something or go into debt. We are all in an economy that does not seem to be working for working people anymore. And so much of my policies are about finding ways to lower the costs that drive us all nuts, from childcare to prescription drugs, dramatically lowering them and raising incomes through very creative, obvious though means. Like something as simple, I have something called the RISE credit, which would double to take away these Trump toxic tax cuts that went to the wealthiest mm-hmm. and double the earned income tax credit. That alone would raise the incomes of 150 million Americans. It would cut poverty in America by a third. And again, we could pay for it by reversing Trump tax cuts and focusing on working people in America, driving down costs from prescription drugs. We can do that. I have a bill right now that I'm going to make law as president for affordable childcare in this mm-hmm. country, because most states, childcare costs more than the tuition at the local college. Mm-hmm. And speaking of that, college tuition in this country is ridiculously out of control. And these are burdens now on a generation of Americans that are driving their wealth down. Baby boomers, when they were the age of millennials, now they control a third of American wealth. Millennials now, it's about 3-4% of American wealth because they have such debt burdens and work is not paying like it used to. And so that's why I have debt-free college and a lot of other strategies to deal with this crisis of affordability and income in the country. If you are the majority of Americans, will see their wages increased under me because of the tax changes we're going to make. They'll see sources of income go up, which we can talk about housing and more, and they will see costs going down, prescription, drugs, child care, and more.
Todd?
So, Senator, it's nice to see you here.
It's good to be here, Todd. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. So we have about 225,000 members in New Hampshire, a great majority of whom tend to vote. And I'm the state director of that group, and I'm honored to do it. We're pretty focused in this election, as you know, on prescription drugs.
Yes.
And there's a few other issues I'd like to talk to you a little bit about today, prescription drugs being the first, and then we can talk a little about Social Security and maybe home and community-based services, helping
Please.
People age in place.
Yes.
Let's start with the first one because it dovetails on a question that Chris had raised and an answer that you had brought up as well. So for more than a decade, brand name prices of prescription drugs have been just soaring. So between 2012 and 2017, they've been up some 57%. In that same period of time, between 2012 and 2017, granted state incomes have been up around 13.2%. So obviously a real disconnect between, in many cases, a fixed cost for many people who take, some people over, older Americans take on average 4.5 meds a day. So it's a big deal. You multiply that spread. So if you're elected president, and knowing that there's a real disconnect between inflationary pressure on wages and inflationary reality in prescription drugs, what would you do to lower drug prices, specifically, Senator?
Yeah, so this is a moral crisis and it's an economic crisis. I sat with a man in a senior home. I'm just coming out of Iowa, and his name's Mr. Douglas. He's a diabetic. And he just said to me point blank, I'm supposed to take my insulin 3 times a day. I take it 2 times a day because I can't afford it. People are rationing drugs that then, the reason why I say it's not only morally wrong, it's economically wrong because I know this from my community. People end up in hospital emergency rooms. This is for a case of diabetes. You can end up in diabetic shock. And that actually costs our system more. You know, and I know you know this, private companies now are giving away drugs for free in order to keep their employees on their medication so they bend their overall health cost curves. We do the exact opposite as a nation, give everybody incentives not to go to doctors, not to take their drugs, because copays or prescription drug prices are too high. So specifically, because this is an issue where I've written the legislation to do things on this as a senator, and we'll get it done as President of the United States. Number one, the obvious one, allow Medicaid, Medicare to negotiate drug prices to drive them down. They're their number one consumers. It is egregious that we don't do this already. That's going to give great savings. Number two, safety valve. Other countries. I wrote legislation with Senators Casey and Senator Sanders, the premier legislation, to allow safe importations, not just from Canada, but from other peer nations. Number three, I believe in taking away patents. I really do. Because if you are charging the same amount, and by the way, a lot of our research, public research dollars go into designing these drugs.
NIH.
Exactly, through the NIH. And then those private companies take our collective wealth, the taxpayer dollars, and they jack up prices in our country 5, 10, I'm not exaggerating, 50, 100 times more than they sell the same drug in a peer nation. There was a famous controversy. My senior senator had this running against a guy who was a pharmaceutical executive. He exposed the guy. His company was charging 50% less in Russia for a drug that they were selling 50% more in our country. In other words, Putin could buy the drug cheaper than American citizens. And so I'm sorry, that kind of profiteering is going to stop under my leadership. The bill I have in the Senate, what I'm going to make law here, creates an independent agency that will monitor drug prices. And if you're violating that simple precept, which is do not charge companies, do not charge our American citizens higher drug prices in this country than other peer nations. We're taking away patents and ending this profiteering. Those things will start to drive down prescription drugs significantly. And I think there's other things we can do. Frankly, this is why I think having Medicaid and Medicare right now, starting to expand some of the services that they're giving. We know, I've talked with a lot of the folks for AARP and other groups about the donut hole and other things that we can begin to address to make sure that no senior, no person in our country is rationing their drugs or putting aside life-saving drugs because they can't afford it.
How do you pull the patents? Do you think because of an executive agency issues them, you have the authority to pull them? Or is that going to require like ongoing litigation?
It will be litigated. I'm confident sure. Because it's never been done before. But first of all, there is law already that says in a national health crises, we can relax patents. So there's, and I would argue that we are in some national health crises. But this would have to be legislation that would be passed through Congress, which brings up the other issue. Well, Corey, you got 50 votes in the Senate. You need 60 votes to pass major legislation. What makes things you're going to be able to do things that, frankly, Obama wasn't able to do a lot of things he wanted to do around health care? Well, that's why I tell people, please elect a president, not just because of their all the senators I know are really, we're all very sophisticated about this issue. We're running for president. It's not just the person with the best policy ideas. It's who's had the best track record for getting things done in bipartisan ways. I was a mayor of a city with a Republican governor named Chris Christie and got transformative things done through public education as well as turning our economy around because I was able to work to find common ground. In the Senate, the only major bipartisan bill that Democrats told me couldn't get passed under this president. The only one, the major one to pass was for criminal justice reform. I led it. I helped write it from the Senate, Democratic side in the Senate. My track record for finding common ground, pulling people together, is one of the things I can tell people to assure you that I'm going to drive your prescription drug prices down.
So somewhat related to that, how would you specifically hold the drug companies themselves accountable for the high prescription drug prices? So, I mean, you have the power of the presidency. I mean, what is it that you would do in a Booker presidency, Booker administration, versus the prescription pharmaceutical industry?
Yeah, well, one is when we get legislation passed, when I use Medicare to drive things down, these are specific things that will force prices down. Actually, free market forces, i.e. I'm buying it, I'm gonna negotiate from you, or I'm getting my drugs someplace else. Those market forces will drive things down. But the last thing I want to say, I use words like moral because I am here because of legislation that changed because of a moral movement in America. The longest filibuster blocking change in the Senate was a guy named Strom Thurmond, who tried to stop legislation changing that was moral legislation. It was a civil rights movement. And the way we overcame that is because we had artists of activism that called to the conscience of our country, not a partisan fight. They brought good people of good conscience. So I'm going to be a leader that understands. When I was mayor of the city of Newark, I knew that my role was a moral role. You'll know my history. I lived on food stamps to attract attention, get outrage about what people there. We did a hunger strike when I was a city council person. Got thousands of people involved with a very dangerous area because I brought moral leverage to the policy fights that I was trying to do all along. When I'm president of the United States, I'm going to break norms like this president does. He does them to demean, degrade, divide, to pit us against each other. But I'm going to be a president that breaks norms to call a movement together, a healthcare movement, because I don't believe these things are policy issues. I believe they're fundamental rights in this country. Healthcare is a human right, and every American should have access to healthcare and prescription and affordable prescription drugs.
Todd, one more thing briefly, but as the senator has to run.
So the last question is, if no action is taken, Social Security trust funds will face a shortfall by 2035, something I'm sure you know about, and Medicare by 2026. So what would you do to update and strengthen both Social Security and Medicare for future generations? And not Medicare, you know, I know Medicare for All is a different discussion.
I understand what you're saying.
As it currently exists.
Yeah, and may I also pivot, just I know time's short, but your long-term care illusion you made before, I really want to address that as well. So I'm going to do this as a speed round.
Okay.
The Social Security is just so obvious. I have legislation, again, in the Senate to do this. We right now, the Social Security tax is a regressive tax. Literally, if you make $100,000 a year, you're paying more in Social Security tax percentage of your income than someone who makes $250,000 a year. What we need to do is lift the cap on the highest income earners in America. So we can lift the cap on 4 or 5% of Americans, let them pay a little bit more into the account, and relieve that pressure. Stabilize Social Security, but something more that I want to do in my legislation, which is expand Social Security payments. We have millions of seniors that live effectively at or below the poverty line, millions, because their Social Security checks don't go far enough. My common sense legislation, which stops a regressive tax for the wealthiest, it solves that crisis. Again, this is the same thing with Medicare. We can find ways to get more money if we have a more just taxation system. But here's the thing. again, why I talk about these things is, what are our values as a country? We are this nation that treats our elderly with such disrespect. We say to our elderly in this country, if you're going to qualify for Medicaid, you need to bleed through your entire life savings and go into poverty before you qualify. You've worked all your life. Maybe you want to pass things on to your kids, but we don't believe in that. So when I talk about lifting caps, the other cap we're going to lift on for Medicaid eligibility, if you want to go into a nursing home, we're going to make sure that your savings cap is going to be lifted. We're going to say income caps are lifted, 300% of poverty line. These things are going to help create sanity, but it's even more challenging. And this is where I'm embarrassed. I didn't become an activist on this issue until I saw what my mom did, who was taking care of my father with Parkinson's and dementia. I saw her bleeding through her savings. I saw her physical condition as a caregiver at home. When my father's dementia made him think that he had to go outside in the middle of the night, half dressed, and my mom literally had to wrestle with him to keep him there until we were able to come up with the money to get her nighttime coverage. There are so many Americans that are trying to do right by their loved ones, but they're isolated and they're alone, and we don't have a system here that treats them with dignity. And by the way, you know this, at home health care worker, that family member, if they weren't there, it would cost society more money. This is what I'm saying. The moral issues and the economic issues line up, but we're violating both economic common sense and moral common sense. So I have a very detailed long-term plan on, and I hope people go to my website, CoryBooker.com, and read them. But here are some just common sense principles. Not only raising the cap on income and savings to keep you, if you want to go to a nursing home, but people should have the choice of aging at home with dignity. We should have policies that do that. And the workers, home healthcare workers, my legislation talks about paying them $15 an hour or more. But let me go specifically to my mom, because I meet people all over this country. That person is doing work, but it's not qualified as work. So they don't qualify for the earned income tax credit. My doubling the earned income tax credit not only helps 150 million Americans get a pay increase, but it says it changes the definition of work, so that if you're home taking care of a special needs child, a spouse with Alzheimer's, a parent with special needs, you qualify for the earned income tax credit too. You can get thousands of dollars back in your pocket. So this, to me, this whole issue we're talking about, I know this, people think this is policy, and it is, but undergirding all policy, civil rights legislation, voting rights legislation, suffrage legislation, rights for LGBTQ Americans, workers' rights, all undermining all these changes and advances we did, is us coming to a consensus in our country about what our real values are. I believe with our seniors right now, our policies are indefensible based upon the common values that we have. That's why I'm running this election, to say this election is not about one guy in one office. It's not a referendum on him, it's a referendum on us. What are our values as a society? Who are we going to be to each other? And if we make this election all about him, I'm sorry. We do a disservice to the American public, because that doesn't heal this country. We need to start elevating our values and our ideals. That will overwhelm people like him who stand for taking away health care. And it will help us to not only win him back in office, but not in a partisan way, win it in a way that's calling more Americans to come together to deal with these issues.
Do you think within the noise and the clutter of our time that Americans will hear the moral appeal you're talking about?
Yeah. You know why? Carter came here after the people were just done with Nixon, and all he talked about in New Hampshire was grace, mm-hmm. and decency, and that actually won out in the end. Why am I leading in endorsements? I see local mayor after state senator here in the state telling me, you know why? I'm in the pit trying to make legislation here in New Hampshire. We need people that are going to remind us that the lines that divide us are not as strong as the ties that bind us. You're the candidate that can help us put more indivisible into this one nation under God. We're catching momentum because of that. But I'm not one of these people that's polling my message. You see a lot of people changing their message along the way. This is who I am. This is what I've been talking about. I want to be president. Why? Not because I'm not smarter than the other candidates running. We're all good policy people. But we're not going to win on a better 15-point policy plan. We lost the last election with somebody who had a better 15-point policy plan. What we need of the next president is those who can best expand the moral imagination of this country. That's why I'm in this race. That's why I think I'm catching ground right now. That's what I think America needs. I pray to God that you'll give me a chance to be that kind of leader, because if that's the case, we're not going to just beat Donald Trump and send Mitch McConnell back to the back benches. We're going to take our nation to higher moral ground.
And those values are the exact same ones when you first came to New Hampshire, and I saw you in December, that you had then, and it's stayed remarkably consistent. Really appreciate your time. Thanks for coming
in,
and we'll talk
much.
Again soon.
Thank you both. Thank
Cory
you.
Booker here on New Hampshire.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now with Chris Ryan, presented by the New Hampshire College and University Council.